Welcome back to Open Line at WOSU 820. This hour, a look at women of faith who are making a difference in the world, working for social justice for the poor, the neglected and abused, for prisoners, for social outcasts. And these women are doing so from a motivation which is religious, not secular. My guest today, Auburn Theological Seminary educator Catherine Rhodes Henderson, says these women are spiritual activists, spiritual entrepreneurs. She says they all have an infectious passion for doing justice. And all these women of spirit, she says, have sharp critiques of mainstream religion, but they've not given up on it. They seek to revivify, my guest says, the root messages about doing justice, which lie at the core of traditional religion. The women we'll find out about this hour are progressive Christians, Jews, Muslims, and feminist spiritual eclectics. They're so committed to a better world that they've invented organizations and movements to change the world. Good examples of how one person can still make a difference. We'll find out more. Catherine Rhodes Henderson is Executive Vice President of Auburn Theological Seminary in New York City, which educates leaders of many religious traditions. She's an ordained Presbyterian minister. She is co-founder of Face to Face, Faith to Faith. It's a multi-faith youth program dedicated to educating a new generation of peacemakers. Her new book is God's Troublemakers, How Women of Faith Are Changing the World, from Auburn Theological Seminary, New York City. Welcome, Catherine Rhodes Henderson. Good to have you here.
Great to be here with you, Fred.
And we're at 614-292-8513 when you'd like to join our conversation. Catherine, you begin God's Troublemakers by asking a number of questions, including what motivates people to try to change the world when faced with injustice? Why do some people walk away while others stop and respond and act? And what, if anything, does God have to do with it? Well, what does God have to do with it?
What I've found in the women that I interviewed for God's Troublemakers are that these women who are Jews, Christians, and Muslims often have deep faith that has been nurtured from childhood on in some cases, and that their belief in God, their enduring belief in a power greater than themselves is what fuels their desire to do work in the world, mm-hmm. to change the world.
And you say there are root messages about doing justice which lie at the core of traditional religion. Tell me about those messages.
Right. Their traditions, for Christians, we believe that Jesus was somebody who was a change agent where he was, you know, some of his final messages were to feed the hungry, to take care of those in the greatest need. And there are, streams of that core sort of message in Judaism, certainly. You know, Jews believe in tikkun olam, which is repairing the world. That's a core message for Jews, to repair the world, to heal and repair the world. And Muslims have similar mandates to take care of the least of these, of those in need. And so a lot of these women really hew to that core line of their faith traditions.
You quote the Muslim scholar and activist Rifat Hassan,
right.
a woman who set up a social change organization, as saying, look, this is at the core of Islam, to take care of the least fortunate.
That's right. That's
well,
right. And that was how I was brought up.
Well, is there something unusual about this? I mean, in other words, do you think that people don't understand that this is at the core message of their faith?
I think that in some ways, what I've seen and what I talk about in the book is I've been a Presbyterian minister for 25 years, and during that time I have seen, we've seen certainly the rise of the religious right, and that the religious right has gotten a lot of attention in the media. But my religion, which is called the mainline, sort of more liberal forms of religion, have taken kind of a back seat, have not been so prominent, have not been so much in the fore. And certainly we don't hear so much in the news from imams and rabbis and other leaders of other faith traditions. So there's been kind of a retreat, I think. I grew up in the civil rights movement. My parents were activists, and some of my earliest memories were of, marching in civil rights marches, feeling that experience of people walking their faith, and being together, leading movements for change. And that was, you know, that was a very vivid message for me growing up. And I think that we haven't seen so much of that of late. Mm-hmm. There's been kind of a retreat. We may be seeing more of it coming to the fore now. Certainly, political candidates talk a lot these days about how to talk about their religious faith.
Mm-hmm. You say religious moderates and liberals have appropriated a code of silence.
Yeah, I think there has been a kind of code of silence. Certainly not not talking so much about their religion in public. You know, religion has kind of gone somewhat underground for a lot of us. You know, it's okay to practice a faith, but it's not something that you want to take out in public very much. I talk about this in the book. Sort of a litmus test of this is being on an airplane and having somebody sit next to you, and, you know, you pick up a conversation and somebody says, you know, well, what do you do? And so I go through the thought process. Do I tell them I'm a Presbyterian minister? Do I say I'm an educator? You know, what is it? And often when you actually reveal that you're a religious leader, the person kind of, you know, retreats, or at least you can see the process in their mind trying to remember exactly what they had said prior to finding out that I'm a minister.
Hmm.
It's a religious leader is behavior police, that kind of thing. Did they say anything incriminating?
Well, now, conservative Christians don't hesitate to speak out,
That's true. I think conservative Christians have probably done a better job of speaking out, of speaking about their faith, and certainly using the media effectively for that purpose.
Well, is there an embarrassment among religious moderates and liberals about their faith?
I don't think it's an embarrassment so much as just not. It's just not something that we do. It's not something that we've got very good at practicing. So we've let the airwaves and we've let the one side dominate the rhetoric.
Well,
I also think that partly for us, for those of us who are more moderates or progressives, that we respect pluralism. We respect the other. And so that sometimes makes us hesitant to talk about our own religious traditions, our own faith.
Mm-hmm. Now, talking about the traditions is one thing, but the women you profile in God's Troublemakers, Catherine, they're not just talking, they're doing, right?
They're actually doing, absolutely.
And they're working with the poor, with prisoners, with people who have HIV, people who would be sometimes social outcasts in other contexts.
Mm-hmm.
Do moderate and liberal religious people, have they neglected this as well? In other words, they're not speaking out, but are they also not doing?
Well, I think that the women in my book, a lot of them would say, that organized religion, churches, synagogues, and other religious communities have not done enough to address these social needs. I would say that they would say that, which is part of why they're filling in the breach. I mean, mm-hmm. In a lot of cases, let's take a couple of examples.
Yes.
Sister Helen Prejean, probably the most famous woman in my book, who wrote Dead Man Walking and is, you know, now the leader of an international movement to end the death penalty. She had been a nun for decades before getting involved in the criminal justice system and getting involved as a, you know, leader for change. I mean, as she puts it, I had been a nun, I'd been following Jesus all my life, but I never really connected with people in real need. She would go out to teach during the day, but would get back to the to the community where she lived as fast as possible at the end of the day. She thought about that faith was all about prayer and praying and getting closer to God, but it didn't really connect with people in need.
Mm-hmm.
And so the connecting with people in need is what changed her. A lot of the women in my book got involved in social change movements and in building organizations from the ground up and starting things that had never existed because of one person in need, because of actually one situation. Sister Helen received a letter asking her to write to somebody on death row. And she wrote that letter and then visited the man on death row, and probably a lot of people know this story, and that hooked her for life, as she said. And there were others, other examples of women who experienced one person in need. A chance encounter, for example, with a newspaper story. Another woman, Hannah Hahn, was reading the newspaper in Queens, in New York City, one day, and about a woman in the South who had been wrongly accused or had been accused of killing a child, killing her child. And Hannah took a trip South and found that this woman had been wrongly accused, partly because her English was, you know, was not clear. And so Hannah started something called the Rainbow Center, really to address the needs of this one woman who represented a lot of other women, Asian women, who had particular needs.
Isn't that interesting how just reading a newspaper article or being asked to write a letter to an inmate changed someone's life entirely?
Well, and of course you have to be open. I mean, one of my core questions that you mentioned when we started the interview is, why in the face of suffering do some people walk by while others stop, take notice, and act? And that's sort of a core question that I've always had with me. And these women are people who actually let need touch them, touch their hearts, and then, you know, touch their lives, and in some cases, you know, change their lives completely. It moves them reorients them in a whole different direction.
My guest, Catherine Rhodes Henderson, is Executive Vice President of Auburn Theological Seminary in New York City. Her new book is God's Troublemakers, How Women of Faith Are Changing the World. And Catherine Henderson is going to speak for the Columbus Metropolitan Club this Wednesday, April 25th at noon at the Athletic Club in Columbus, a speech and luncheon. And for information about how you can attend, you can call the Columbus Metropolitan Club at 464-3220, of course, area 614, and then 464-3220. Catherine, your question, when you say when faced with injustice, why do some people walk away while others stop, respond, and act? I guess most of us walk away, huh?
I think, yes, most of us do, and yet some of us are compelled to, you know, to stop, and some of us, you know, even though we may professionally do other things, we actually do get involved in social change. The women in my book, and really this is the message of the book, these are special women, yes, but the message of the book is that all of us can do our part to change the world. That it's, you know, that it doesn't take heroic effort necessarily, but it, you know, it really takes. It's a matter of, you know, one person at a time changing the world. The women inspired me. You know, after doing research on a book, and it takes a long time, the thoughts of the women got inside of me, and I was inspired, which I hope will be true for others who read the book. And I co-founded Face to Face, Faith to Faith, which brings teenagers, young leaders from around the world, South Africa, Northern Ireland, the Middle East, and the U.S. together, Jews, Christians, and Muslims. And so...
When you bring them together, for what purpose now?
To learn, in some cases, it's to meet the enemy other for the very first time. I have Israeli and Palestinian kids who've never met the other, who've never sat down with the person, you know, across the table whom they have been taught as the enemy, the one to be hated. So the purpose is in some cases to have that initial meeting, and then to learn through communication skills how you talk to people who are different, how you tell your story, how you learn that there are multiple narratives often. You know, we may live in the same place as Muslims, Christians, and Jews, but our stories and our understanding of our reality may be entirely different from each other. So how do you do that? How do you communicate? And then we learn about our faith traditions and how our traditions can be resources for making peace. That's what these kids learn. And then they make plans when they go home. They stay with us at least a year and often longer to pursue projects in their home countries. Kids in South Africa work on issues of AIDS, for example, Israelis and Palestinians. We had kids who did a whole project around visiting the wall that has been built. For some, it feels like security, and for some, it feels like a prison. And it doesn't change the reality necessarily, but it certainly changes people's perceptions of it and understanding of it. And so our kids took their parents and classmates and others to experience this together. That sort of thing doesn't happen in that part of the world, not very much.
Well, Catherine, you say you were inspired by the women you talked to for God's Troublemakers. But what inspired you to do this particular thing?
You know, Fred, sometimes a vocation finds you when you least expect it, and that's how it was with face-to-face. Our board here at Auburn, one of our big focuses is on multi-faith education, how people relate to each other across lines of religious difference. And our board said, we need to do some of this work with youth. We do a lot of work with adults, but it's time to work with young leaders. And so that was on sort of a low burner for a while, and I met a woman who'd been working with teenage girls, Israelis and Palestinians, and so we combined forces and launched this face-to-face program together, mm-hmm. combining Auburn's expertise in multi-faith education and hers in working with youth, her efforts and mine. She is a social worker, I as an educator and minister, and that's how it was born. I wouldn't have chosen teenagers necessarily, you know, sometimes things come to you.
Mm-hmm. You know, Sister Helen Prejean, leading the anti-death penalty movement internationally, Hannah Hahn, who you say founded the Rainbow Center, for particularly to deal with Asian women who maybe have different colors, and others as well. These are social entrepreneurs, you call them in a way. But I wondered as I read the book, gee, there may be some of us who would like to do good, but, you know, our personalities don't go along with setting up a big organization
right.
or leading an international movement.
Exactly.
Right?
Exactly. I think that everybody can find that thing that sort of evokes passion for doing good and for making change. I call it public issue literacy. You know, what is that thing in the world? Is it the environment? Is it, you know, taking care of the rivers and streams near you? Is it, you know, visiting somebody in prison? Is it women and girls? You know, women and girls often, you know, in the foundation world, they don't receive a lot of coverage and money, philanthropic money. So maybe it's you know, women in need, low income women. Maybe it's boys. You know, boys are having a tremendously hard time. I mean, we certainly saw that this past week. And you all, you know, in the Columbus area and in Ohio are certainly, you know, feeling this, I'm sure. And along with the rest of us, you know, young men are struggling so these days. Maybe it's boys, helping boys. You know, I think we can all do our part. You know, it doesn't take founding an organization. It doesn't take reorienting your whole life. Maybe opening your heart and orienting your heart, and also learning about issues. You know, a lot of people are here in my circle of friends are very concerned about Darfur now, and are focusing on that.
Mm-hmm. We're at 614-292-8513 with Catherine Rhodes Henderson, Executive Vice President of Auburn Theological Seminary in New York City, and her new book is God's Troublemakers, How Women of Faith Are Changing the World. And again, my guest speaks this Wednesday, April 25th, at the Columbus Metropolitan Club luncheon, and you can get information about attending at 464-3220. I guess it is a question of finding out what our passion is, right? Taking a look at all the needs around us and saying, gee, this is one that I really resonate with and one where I think not only is it one that I care about, but it's one where I see a role for myself, or I could see
right.
maybe a role for myself. Huh?
Yes, I think it's as simple as that. I mean, you know, often in our world today in the U.S., we're very, you know, we lead very separate lives. We're scared about people who are different. You know, certainly Muslims in this country have had such a hard time since 9/11. You know, it may be as simple as, you know, reaching out and, you know, saying hello and finding out about the person who is your closest neighbor you know, who may be different in some way. You know, maybe that person is Muslim. I mean, simply asking them, you know, what they believe and how they believe and how life is for them. And, you know, it can be as simple as that.
Mm-hmm. We've talked about Sister Helen Prejean, Hannah Hahn with the Rainbow Center. Let's talk about some of the other women you talked to for the book. Gretchen Buchenholz.
Yes.
Again, this was a situation where she came upon something almost accidentally, a situation, and this letter to really change her life.
Yeah, it did. Gretchen, this was over 20 years ago now, went to an office in a municipal building in New York City and opened the wrong door and found families, people, sitting, you know, a huge number, sitting and waiting, and it smelled terribly, the room of diarrhea. These children were crying, and she noticed that there was an office door, and there were scratch marks on the door where that went up as high as the height of little children. And they were literally, you know, sort of clawing at the door because they were hungry.
What kind of a place was this?
This was a sort of holding pen for homeless families at that time. And she was just absolutely shocked and appalled. And so she had quarters to make phone calls. She was not... This was not her area of work, but she called the mayor's office. She called the New York Times for a reporter and a photographer, and she went across the street to McDonald's and to a store and brought back diapers and peanut butter and enough food to get people started. And that reporter and photographer came, and as she said, it started to spin in the press after that.
So this is kind of some kind of holding center for homeless people that was run by the city,
Probably waiting. You know, people were waiting to be processed or whatever. I'd like to think this doesn't happen in New York City anymore, but or any other city. But I think, you know, we certainly saw similar scenes in New Orleans around Hurricane, you know, around Katrina. Sites that, you know, most of us would never have imagined would happen in this country.
So Gretchen Buchenholz starts by calling the New York Times, which is a very smart move, and also by going and simply getting some peanut butter and some disposable diapers and things. And then what did she go on to do from that?
She went on to found the Association to Benefit Children, which has grown into a multimillion dollar organization with a number of locations around the city. It's very well known here. And The idea initially and still is to change the myriad threats to childhood, you know, based on the idea that every child deserves a childhood, enough food to eat, love, you know, education, a future, and as she puts it sort of wryly, sometimes shoes. There are many kids now who have gone through her program.
Surely. Catherine Rhodes Henderson, Executive Vice President of Auburn Theological Seminary in New York, her new book, God's Troublemakers, How Women of Faith Are Changing the World. We'll be back after these messages at WOSU 820, your all-day NPR news station.
Jennifer Magnus learned about the blues as a hitchhiking kid from the wrong side of the tracks. 30 years later, she's still singing them.
I found out I don't get nowhere with weakness if I dream about you.
I'm Linda Wertheimer. The Blue Notes of Jennifer Magnus plus the latest news Saturday on Weekend Edition from NPR News.
Got to do without you, I don't want you.
Weekend Edition Saturday begins tomorrow morning starting at 8 a.m. Good morning from WOSU 820. I'm Amy Jarovich. Thanks for joining us for Open Line this morning. This is an encore presentation of the best of Open Line. No phone calls, please. It is 77 degrees at 10:30. Your membership with WOSU provides for the news and information you rely on. And in this pivotal election year, your support is more important than ever. Becoming a member is easy when you go online to wosu.org/give. and thank you for your continued support of WOSU 820 and NPR News. Be sure to listen to Morning Edition now on WOSU 89.7 FM for your weekday morning update on the news. It's from 5 to 9 a.m. In the weather forecast for today, a nice day for a Friday in central Ohio, mostly sunny and a high near 89. For tonight, mostly clear with a low of 66. And on Saturday, partly sunny and a high of 88.
Welcome back to Open Line, the WOSU 820. I'm Fred Anderle. This hour, a look at women of faith who are making a difference in the world working for social justice. Again, my guest, Catherine Rhodes Henderson, Executive Vice President of Auburn Theological Seminary in New York. They educate leaders of many religious traditions. My guest is an ordained Presbyterian minister. She is co-founder of Face to Face, Faith to Faith, a multi-faith youth program dedicated to educating a new generation of peacemakers from around the world. Her new book is God's Troublemakers, How Women of Faith Are Changing the World. And if you'd like to join our conversation today with your insights, your thoughts, your questions, 614-292-8513. Catherine, very interesting. People like Gretchen Buchenholz, who we just talked about, and Hannah Hahn, and Sister Helen Prejean, the anti-capital punishment movement. All of these women said to you, although they have founded organizations and have been in a great sense, become administrators, mm-hmm. nonetheless, they've got to keep in touch with people on a one-to-one basis or their energy flags.
Right. Yes, and I think this is something that that's a very helpful pattern in their lives that can help all of us. I called it the one-on-one systemic dance because a lot of these women started, you know, just reaching out to one person in need, as I said before, and then after they, you know, they founded their organizations, and the organizations grew, and they became, you know, fundraisers and administrators. Often, you know, it would be other staff at another level who would be dealing with, you know, with the one-on-one, with the need, with a direct service. So, keeping in touch with people in need was just a sort of lifeline. It kept the work current and lively. Sister Helen said, if you're separated from people in need, then you start doing a commentary on the work, but you're not really connected to it anymore. You're just doing a commentary on it, and that was really true for a lot of them. As some of them started to flag at times, that was what they articulated as wanting to do, getting back to the one-on-one. Here is this food, you know, that I bring you, that I'm feeding you with. Ganga Stone founded something called God's Love We Deliver. She had taken food. She was a volunteer who took food at one point. This is, you know, several decades ago now, to a man with AIDS. She took a bag of groceries to him, and what she realized when she got into his apartment was he could not prepare the food. The bag of groceries did nothing for him, and so out of that, she founded God's Love We Deliver, and it's still going on today and delivers thousands of meals, hot meals, cooked meals to people suffering with HIV and AIDS. For Ganga, what was important was getting back, you know, or keeping in touch with, you know, here is this food that I bring you, that I feed you with, and that was the lifeline for her.
So in other words, she keeps in touch. She delivers some of the food, you're saying?
Probably. She has actually moved on to other things, but yes, that was for a period of time a real lifeline for her. Mm-hmm. Another person, Connie Baugh, who founded Citizen Advocates for Justice, working with women in prison and after they come out of prison. In fact, she founded a church called the Church of Gethsemane for women, ex-prisoners and their families. It was keeping in touch, sitting with these women over time that kept her connected. I feel that for myself with face-to-face. Faith to faith. I recently got back from a trip to Israel in the West Bank, and going to, you know, see some of my kids and seeing them in their home territory, in their communities, meeting their parents, seeing the work close at hand, hearing what's going on in their lives at this juncture, you know, that's what makes it possible for me to do all of the other work of face-to-face, including all of that fundraising and administration that takes up so much time.
Some of that fundraising and administration can be kind of boring, too, can it?
I think when you're connected to the work and you see the importance of it, fundraising is fun because you're raising the money that can do this important work.
It's
totally connected, you know, to what you're doing.
When you went to see some of these young people who you had been with you for a year-long program, right, to talk about being peacemakers, and
right.
then they go back home, and you went to see them in Israel, what are some of the kinds of things they were doing?
I had mentioned the project around the separation barrier wall that they had been working on. They often visit each other's as they can. I mean, it's not always easy, but they visit each other's communities. They learn about each other's practices around holidays. They do all sorts of projects. For example, going to work together to paint a program, an after-school program, a building for Palestinian children. We have one young man who is a Orthodox Jew who has been working with a group called Rabbis for Human Rights and going with some of those other Jews to the West Bank, into the West Bank, to work with Palestinian olive farmers to help them harvest their olives. Sometimes that's hard to do, and there have in fact been settlers who have disrupted the farming of olive trees and in some cases set fire to olive trees as a protest. And so one of our young men is there, you know, helping to harvest the olives. That's mm-hmm. That's really action.
Now, of course, these are all the women who set up these organizations, including yourself, obviously, are women of faith. This could have been done just as easily by women who were agnostics or atheists or ethical humanists or whatever. Huh? I mean, is God really necessary here?
I think that people find the support or the motivation wherever. I mean, I think for the women in my book, and these were not sort of pious, preachy. These are women that you'd like to have a cup of coffee with.
Mm-hmm.
They're not intimidating. They're funny. They're irreverent. But faith really did, for this group of women, faith really did undergird and support their work. I mean, they had wonderful images of God that they fell back on. God... Jan Orharder, who is a Presbyterian minister and a peacemaker, has worked on the nuclear freeze campaign a long time ago and still works on peacemaking issues today. And she envisioned God as sort of underneath, not God above and high up and mighty, but God underneath who pulled and pushed her through hard times, you know, when things really got rough in the peace movement. So images like that...
Mm-hmm. Very powerful.
We're very powerful. Not God as the knight in shining armor that rescues you, but the fellow sufferer, the sister sufferer who understands, you know, that God is the one who suffers with. So, reframing how God looks. One woman, Jenny Thornburg, who works around the disability movement, had a father who was involved in the shipping business, and she remembered going as a little girl along the wharfs and seeing the big nets, with cargo in them coming off of ships.
Yes.
And for her, that was kind of an image of God, that God was like the big net that could hold her, you know, no matter what happened.
You know, you say that these women as well had sharp critiques of mainstream religion, huh?
Well, sharp critiques of religion or how religion is lived out or interpreted. Certainly, Rifat Hassan, as a Muslim woman, has seen how the Quran itself has been misinterpreted or interpreted through writings that are around the Quran and that do not support the equality of men and women. And often, you know, these writings and interpretations, you know, are used, misused, abused to support things like honor killings, you know, which is the abuse and torture and sometimes killing of women by even men in their own family in Muslim countries, you know, for purported wrongdoings. So that's a case, you know, where religion has been hijacked for violent and immoral purposes.
Rifat Hassan, how did she begin her what is her work in particular?
She is an academic and is a studies text and has studied the Quran for many years, and women activists in Muslim countries contacted her asking her to join them in their movement for change, fighting honor killings. So that was how she got involved. Mm-hmm. That was how an academic, somebody who's used to being in a classroom and used to studying as a scholar, is called into service, you know, by women who need. And her idea is to make better religious arguments and to get back to the core writings of the text, core writing of the scripture, and to do some reinterpretation of those texts. So, the kind of thing that Jewish and Christian women have been doing for a long time.
Mm-hmm. So in her organization then, and helping oppose honor killings, is she still functioning pretty much as a scholar, or is she active in
different
ways?
I think some of both. Mm-hmm. Some of both.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Tell me about Rabbi Mikhail Springer. When you talked with her, she was a chaplain at New York's Beth Israel Hospital.
She was, and she's now an associate dean at Jewish Theological Seminary in New York City. And she's a conservative rabbi and worked as a chaplain trying to bring truth, I would say, to a hospital setting. And the truth is that we live in a society that likes everything to be sunny. We like things sunny and happy and successful. I mean, I think that's, you know, who we are as people here in the United States, and we know that that's not always the way life is. And so as a chaplain, as somebody who was teaching chaplains, Michal helped people to deal with the underside, the shadow side, the things, life when it's not perfect.
You quote her as saying, "People in society at large ignore pain and suffering and focus on how good everything is." She says, "You know, I'll tell you my triumphs and you tell me your triumphs. Yet then we're all isolated." She says, "My sensibility from the hospital is, I know that we're hurting, and let's make room for that." And
yes,
that's where community really happens.
Mm-hmm. Yes, that's right. I mean, helping people to be connectors, connecting to each other, and really relating on a deeper level. I don't know about people in the Columbus area, but often, you know, here in New York, you can go through life without really knowing what's going on with the people around you. And, you know, when you go to a cocktail party or whatever, it's all very, you know, light and what do you do and what do you do? And the more successful you are, the better it is. But we all know that, you know, life is very complicated. And when you get underneath, even those lives that may look perfect on the surface are not so perfect underneath, and it's the opportunity to connect with other people through vulnerability. That was what Michal was getting at there.
And I guess we're all, in a way, connected and united by our suffering, because we all have, as you say, these sufferings in our lives. Nobody's exempt from that.
And nobody's exempt from that, but, you know, denial is very powerful, and we practice it assiduously.
Mm-hmm. My guest, Catherine Rhodes Henderson, is Executive Vice President of Auburn Theological Seminary in New York City. She's an ordained Presbyterian minister. Her new book is God's Troublemakers, subtitled How Women of Faith Are Changing the World. And my guest speaks this Wednesday, April 25th, at the Columbus Metropolitan Club for their noon luncheon at the Athletic Club. And ticket information as to how you can attend, you can call the Columbus Metropolitan Club. Of course, area 614, and their number is 464-3220. That's 464-3220. Catherine, and by the way, if you'd like to call us and join our conversation here, 614-292-8513. Catherine, you talked in terms of these women about and this has got to be difficult, the capacity to see and respond to injustice and evil without being consumed by it. That mm-hmm. must be a hard line to follow.
Yeah, I think it is hard, and I think that's why a lot of us try to avoid it as much as possible. when you, you know, when you see, when you look evil in the face, as, for example, Sister Helen Prejean did, taking, accompanying people on death row to their death, you see evil. You see the evil of the perpetrator. You see the damage that's been done to victims and their families. That's really hard, you know, to live with it. It's hard to carry. That's a role of religious leaders, certainly leaders in congregations. You're there to, you know, carry the weight with people. And that was what Sister Helen was doing. These women, and getting back, this gets back to what McCall was saying about people who like the light. The interesting thing about the women leaders in my book is that they were drawn to need. They were drawn to the shadow. They were drawn to suffering, and, you know, to try to help to alleviate it. So they had the kind of counterintuitive, they made that counterintuitive move to move towards people in need and not away from them.
Did they talk about how they did avoid being overcome and consumed by it? In other words, I can see somebody just seeing all these terrible things, whether it's the families of victims of a person who's murdered, or the murderer, him or herself, or the people who have AIDS and will not be cured in some instances and don't have enough food to eat, and the Asian women who are disconnected from some of the things they need to be connected up with in our society, and realizing that you can only do a little bit. How do you avoid being overcome with despair? Did they talk about that?
They did. As I mentioned before, I mean, their faith in God was certainly something that buoyed them and kept them going. And actually, their relationships with other women. Often they had support networks, reached out to other women. Laura Jervis, who runs a housing ministry here in New York City and has been doing this for probably 30 years now, a really long time, she said, my little cabal of women, you know, that they keep me going. You know, they help me to be more courageous when my energies flag or when I don't want to be courageous anymore. But they're the ones who keep me going. They give me courage. So reaching out, you know, and having that support group, having that support network, and really using that support network and taking the time to do that. Part of the problem with being an activist is that you don't take the time to nurture yourself and keep yourself going. So that was really important. Relationships with other people, relationships with family, spiritual practices of prayer, meditation, physical activity, exercise. Mm-hmm. You know, all of those things that we know are good for us. When you're an activist, you don't always take the time to do them.
I've seen people get very burned out in a very good cause.
You can get burned out in a good cause, and then some people really have the staying power to stay in causes for decades. And some of the women in the book really have that kind of staying power. A couple of women left to have other children, and that was an interesting sort of a different twist on the one-on-one to actually have a child and to get back to that kind of moment of innocence. Where you see the world again, anew.
We talked about these women all saying that they had to not simply administrate, you know, and fundraise, but be in one-to-one contact with, you know, people on death row or women who needed help or whoever they were involved with. I wonder, do you think that's more a need for women activists than it is for male activists? Do you think men are more likely to be able to just administrate and not need the one-to-one contact, or do you think we all do?
I think that we probably all do. People ask me, you know, why didn't you include men in the book? And what I have to say is, in, you know, 20-some years of doing ministry in New York City and other places, the people I saw who sort of followed this pattern were women. They were the ones who were doing this kind of raw, close-to-the-bone sort of work. It's not that men don't do it at all, but they are the ones, you know, who were certainly most visible to me. I think, you know, men may have their own patterns, but I think women do have a special role in healing the world.
What is that special role?
Just as I've described in the book with these women, staying close to those in need, not being fearful of suffering, and you know, being willing to kind of take on the hard things.
Mm-hmm. You talk about previous leaders for social change who used religious language now.
Right.
Martin Luther King certainly did.
Martin Luther King certainly did.
Dorothy Day of the Catholic Worker Movement.
That's right.
Certainly did.
But Sojourner Truth of earlier days, yes.
But,
and Rosa Parks.
But now you talk about the silence of religious moderates and liberals in terms of using that kind of language.
Yes, yes, I think that there has been a silence or a quiet, being quieter, and I think that's changing now. It certainly was changing with these women. I asked them about the use of language. You know, do you use God talk? You know, when do you use God talk? And I guess the overriding theme was carefully. These women really realized the power of conversation about faith to be unifying and energizing, but it can also, talking about God can be very alienating. I start that chapter out, you know, when you're in the car and you turn on the radio and you tune in, you know, do you flip quickly past some talk radio shows, you know, that might be, you know, religious talk radio shows? I'm sure they would never do that with your show, Fred, but they would certainly do that. You know, we certainly all do that. We make our choices. So, you know, religious language can divide you or it can unite mm-hmm. you. And so the women in the book were very careful about when they used religious language.
That's interesting. You didn't get the impression, for example, that Martin Luther King was very careful about when he did that. He seemed to do it very openly, and it seemed to be a uniting factor.
Yes, he did. I mean, he was, you know, certainly brilliant at that. Sister Helen Prejean is brilliant at that. She can. I've heard her talk to groups and groups that span a lot of different religious traditions and, you know, secular people. I mean, and she can, you know, use Christian language in a way that doesn't make people feel alienated or separate.
But that may be a particular.
So certainly Martin Luther King had, you know, tapped into people's souls in a big way. You know, into their dreams, into their hopes,
mm-hmm.
and that's the kind of language. You know, religious language that we need, the kind that unifies, not the kind that divides.
Mm-hmm. And that may be a particular talent, a particular capability, and a particular outlook as well.
I think it's a talent. Some people have it. Certainly the women in the book were trying on language, you know, for size, trying to find how to use religious language in a way that unifies and doesn't divide. And I think there are people who can do that. It's harder now. Because our society is very diverse, you know, we're very pluralistic and increasingly so. So it's hard to find one unifying voice, you know, one voice that sort of speaks for all in the way that was true
mm-hmm.
in the civil rights movement.
We've talked about some of the women, Gretchen Buchenholz and Rabbi Michael Springer and Hannah Hahn and others. Tell us about some of the other, in the few minutes we have left, tell us about some of the other women you talked to and what they have done.
Let's see, Melody Feldman. Melody Feldman is the woman who worked with me, who works with me on the face-to-face program. She's a social worker. She had worked in the area of domestic violence and was in her car driving to work one day in Denver and heard somebody interview on talk radio a young woman in Serbia who was 16. This young woman was heading for her 16th birthday, and you heard the din of gunfire in the background. This interview was happening in a park, and at one point, the interviewer, you know, said, get down, you know, the gunfire was coming closer, and the interviewer was asking this young woman, you know, how she felt about her birthday, and what was happening around her, and this was in the park where they were. Park benches had been torn up because people needed the firewood from the park benches. I mean, it was a, you know, totally devastating situation. And Melody, hearing this, you know, halfway across the world, hearing this young woman say, I don't really care about my life. I don't care if I live or die because, you know, my life is worth nothing right now in this war-torn situation. And Melody, you know, on the spot, you know, with tears running down her face, said, you know, I'm going to work to make sure that 16-year-olds, you know, have a world to look forward to and don't feel in despair when they're reaching their 16th birthday. And so her vow at that moment was to teach kids how to make peace and not wage war.
Do you see those moments in which people come to such a decision as a certain kind of grace?
Absolutely, grace. Yes. I think that you know, God works mysteriously in graceful ways and ways that surprise us all the time. And sometimes we listen and sometimes we don't. So I think in some ways becoming more attuned, becoming better listeners to the urgings of God that come to us through grace. That's a good way to put it.
So many people, you know, the chapter titled in God's Troublemakers is Silence is an Act. And was it Gretchen Buchenholz who talked about that a little bit, who said that, you know, we can act, but by keeping silence, by numbing ourselves to suffering and by doing nothing, that's kind of an act too, huh?
It is an act, yes. It is an act. She said that, you know, the lights in all the cathedrals are out. They're, you know, And she said it just, you know, it takes so little to blow on the coals of my heart is how she put it. But and the hearts of the children that whose needs she was trying to address. But the lights in the cathedrals are out. That was very poignant.
What does she mean by that?
What she means by that, it's the silence is an act. That that the churches, that organized religion need to be much more involved in the needs of the world, less concerned with buildings and maintenance, and more concerned about, you know, getting out there in the world, uniting faith, you know, and belief with activism, with work in the world. And this is, you know, this has happened always. I mean, for women and men, you know, people have been in the pews and people have been in the public square.
You call this kind of faith that these women exemplify a resistance faith, mm-hmm. and you say it's both costly and deeply energizing to sustain it. Maybe you could tell us about that.
Mm-hmm. The idea of resistance faith came to me because when I was 9 years old, I lived at, my father was a professor, and we lived in Germany. We were on sabbatical, and we were introduced to... I was introduced at nine to the story of Dietrich Bonhoeffer, the Lutheran pastor who had been studying in this country and went back to Germany to do whatever he could do to fight the Nazi movement. This was during World War II. And he ended up becoming a leader in the resistance movement to Hitler, that included actually participating in a plot to assassinate Hitler, but there was a whole movement, and there was, the German church was aligned with Nazism, and then there was a sort of a church within the church called the Confessing Church, and that was what he was a part of. So this is the idea that there's often a religious movement within religious movements that is that tries to get back to the core, the root, mm-hmm. and resists the culture, resists some of the forces around it, in that case, Nazism.
Catherine Rhodes Henderson, Executive Vice President of Auburn Theological Seminary in New York City. Her new book is called God's Troublemakers, How Women of Faith Are Changing the World. Catherine, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thank you so much.
At WOSU 820 AM Columbus, on the web at WOSU.org.